ANZ Voices welcomes you to the Business of Bloodstock podcast with co-hosts Justin Darcy and Taylor Dyke.
Welcome to episode 32 of the Business of Bloodstock podcast, proudly sponsored by Morgan & English Law Firm. I'm Justin Darcy, and joining me today is co-host Taylor Dyke, and along with our special guest, Anthony Mithen. A face and a name that most would recognise within the industry, Anthony, or Mitho as most know him as, is the principal of Victoria's prestigious stallion and breeding farm, Rosemont Stud. Togetherness is a tagline of the stud and certainly something Mitho has operated the business around, working closely with partners to bring stallions to the farm and to ensure he has the best team around him to ensure operational efficiency. Not only has Mitho achieved great heights with Rosemont, but boasts a strong media background, which we'll dive into shortly. Mitho, welcome to the Business of Bloodstock.
Thank you, Justin. What a very thoughtful introduction, which I hope at least 80% of that is correct.
Oh, we'll certainly find out during this podcast, won't we? But we'll kick off before going into the Rosemont stuff and the Bloodstock side of things. I want to have a look at your media life. From 1990, you started the Geelong Advertiser as a cadet journalist. Walk us through where your passion for media came from.
Oh, that's a good question. I often get asked what the road looked like, but not the road to get there. So I grew up with both my parents in education and a thirst for knowledge and teaching. And I very quickly became addicted to reading the newspaper because my father bought every newspaper every morning and read it back to front. Although, no, I shouldn't say that. He never bought the Sun because he was a broadsheet sort of guy. So it was always The Age and The Australian. So I soon looked forward to the newspaper arrival as much as he did. My mother's brother is a man called Doug Ayton, who was a journalist and broadcaster of some note. And he probably gave me the exposure to it as a profession. I suppose the gathering of information and the dissemination of that information back to a wider audience was really, you know, foreign to me until I saw what he was doing. So he was the drive time host at ABC Radio in Melbourne for quite a number of years, and was sort of fighting out the ratings with back in the day, 3AW, I think it was. So it was always on in our household in the afternoons. So we'd listen to Uncle Doug do his thing, and I sort of, it was a strange, admiration, but whenever I'd go to Melbourne on the train from Geelong, the train used to amble past as it came into Spencer Street Station. It would amble past the very boring, very ordinary brown brick building that was The Age. And I used to look out the window at that building and say, I'll work there one day. So that was my childhood, sort of with a passion for learning information, finding things out, and then sharing that with other people and realizing that that's what the media do. And that was where my passion was. So I still to this day am far too verbose and tell long stories, and you have all the ability to edit anything and make this a much shorter podcast if you need it to be.
We definitely don't need to. The stories are great and you've got a wealth of knowledge. But adding on, I guess, from your passion, you in the late 90s, you were working as a sports presenter for Channel 9 and specialising in both AFL and horse racing. What did you learn from this period about the sports world in general and, I guess, about racing?
Yeah, it was sort of an evolution. Following on from that, I did walk through the doors of The Age as a young accredited journalist and worked there for 3 years. I bawled my eyes out on my last day driving back over the Westgate Bridge to go to the evils of television, Taylor. The money got me in the end. I had a young family, and Channel 10 was my first pit stop in television. And they just offered me, you know, more money, opportunity, I suppose. But I was quite sad to drive over the Westgate Bridge, leaving the age behind for the last time. And then that couple of year period led to, as you say, work at Channel 9. And I joined I did a bit of racing, whilst at Channel 10 as well. So it had always been, a passion of mine. I like the punt, basically. I was one of those kids that, you know, used to get my quaddies on in my school uniform at lunchtime, and knew Beryl down at the local tab, and she'd greet me with a smile and a welcome, even despite the fact I was 14. It was, "G'day, Anthony, here you go. What do you like today?" So that was sort of where my racing, and that was through my father. He liked to flutter. And loved sport, loved footy, loved racing. We're you know, the apple didn't fall far from the tree. And but to answer your question, what did I learn? I probably learned that we all need each other in racing. That was probably the thing that, you know, trainers. Doing football and then doing racing, I found that trainers and participants in racing really understood the value of media. They understood that it was worthwhile talking to the press, talking to television, getting an interview, you know, on a live broadcast. It meant exposure. It meant an ability to tell a wider market, you know, about themselves and their horses. And I learned that there was a lot of genuine people in there that just, you know, loved the animal. So that was probably the major learnings.
So tying the racing landscape and the AFL landscape together as well, you worked closely with one of our previous podcast guests and Collingwood champion, Michael Christian, on hosting Sports 927 while also commentating the footy for your local Geelong radio station. No doubt it's taken a lot of hard work to get to that point, but geez, it sounds like a lot of fun too.
Yeah, look, it was. I look back on those days of what I was doing at that time, and I'm a bit, I've actually just realised in the last probably few weeks, someone mentioned to me, you've got ADHD, and I'd never contemplate it, but I probably do. I'm quite full on, and I've sort of got to remind myself of that when I'm around people, you know, and pull myself back. My long suffering wife, you know, hats off to her, I would have to say. Because at one stage there, I was working for Channel 9. No, sorry, I was doing breakfast radio with Chris O and Simon O'Donnell. Weekends were spent calling a couple of games of football for K-Rock, which was the Geelong radio station that covers Geelong games and others at that time. I think I was coaching my son's under 14 football, and I was setting up Rosemont as a business. I might have been on the board of the Richmond Football Club as well, and the board of Thoroughbred Breeders Victoria. So, you sort of factor all that in and think, how the hell and why the hell did I do all that? But I probably just had an appetite to say yes and try things and make a contribution where I could. And that sort of led to probably a bit of overload at that time. But it was a lot of fun, and you learn a lot and you meet a lot of people, and it's an interesting, if you put yourself out there and you meet a lot of people and you do a lot of things, it's amazing the opportunities that then arise and the business that you can do or the friendships that you form or the way life looks. So I'm probably more of a, yeah, let's have a go at that sort of guy than, oh, I don't think I can do that, or I don't think that sounds like me, or I probably start at yes, you know, which is not always a good thing, but for me, it's worked out okay.
You speak so fondly of your media days, and it sounds like it was really such an enjoyable part of your life. I guess these days your main focus is probably Rosemont, but I'm sure you still get your little bit of media fix on Moody on the Mic, which is one of my favourite podcasts. I'm an avid listener every week. I'm sure you really get your fix and have a bit of fun every week recording that show.
So you're not the one listening in Nigeria, no?
No, definitely no. Not.
Okay, because we get a weekly summary, and Moods is quite often giving a shout out to the one listener in Nigeria because it's cut down by country. So yes, it's a lot of fun. It's the only thing I do media wise these days, and not because I don't want to. I don't chase it anymore, and I'm a washed up 53-year-old bull guy whose opinion is probably becoming less relevant, but that's okay. I had my time. And that does satisfy, you know, it scratches the itch, Taylor. It's fun to sit down once a week with Moods and Rog and the Rain Man and let Rain Man dissect races that I haven't even looked at yet. And I think my shtick is really just to try and get under Peter's skin as much as I can, which I do a pretty good job of. I'm one of the few people that sort of gets away with it without him, you know, putting a line through you and never talking to you again. So I don't know why that is. It's a funny relationship, Peter's and mine, because he trained a couple of horses for us before he had his little time out from racing, and did his time, which is a whole other story, which I'm a defender of his on that front, by the way. But don't tell him that. It'll ruin the content for the show. But we didn't really know each other, and I'd interviewed him, and he's the type of guy I reckon that is respectful of the media but realises not to get too close. So when I was back in my journo days, he had Black Caviar, and we'd cross paths regularly. We always were cordial to each other but never friendly. And when we started to sort of build Rosemont and had a few more horses, we thought we'd give him a go training, and I thought that'd be an opportunity to sort of get to know him. We never really connected, funnily enough. He was the trainer, I was the owner. He doesn't really, I think Peter's perfect world would be training horses without owners, but that's not practical. So I was, he was, again, always polite, always respectful, but we never really connected. And then when he had his, had the cobalt issue and his license was revoked, and he had his time out. My brother-in-law and myself, it was my brother-in-law's suggestion, actually, and I thought, this is crazy. Why don't we approach him to make him our racing manager? And my initial response was roll the eyes, but as a start with yes man, I thought, oh, well, what's to be lost here? I may as well try. So I rang him and said, I'll shout you lunch at the Emerald Hotel, and didn't tell him why. I just said, I want to catch up. Sat down, we made polite conversation, which was all a little bit awkward. He ordered 24 oysters Kilpatrick, polished them off in about 3.5 minutes. Mm-hmm. I said to him, well, look, you're probably wondering why you're here. And he said, nah, you want me to be your racing manager. I said, who have you spoken to? He said, no one, but it's pretty bloody obvious. He said, I didn't come down in the last shower. He said, I've been offered the job by about 5 organisations. And I'm like, oh, my God, what have I done here? Like, this is a man in demand. I feel very foolish sitting here. And to his unbelievable credit, and I haven't told this story, I don't think ever, not publicly, he sat there and said, I like what you guys are doing. I think I like you. I don't really know your brother-in-law, but he seems like a bloke that has a go. The other offers are with organisations that are quite corporate, big scale. Not sure I want to do that. But they're offering a fair bit of money, to which my heart sank. I thought, well, here we go. We didn't have a lot of money for that role. We might have had 40 or 50 horses in work and, you know, various trainers, but not, you know, we didn't have a big budget for that role. And he said, and factoring all that in, let's give it a go. And I thought, well, the stumbling block will be money. And I said, well, what are we talking? What do I need to give you to do this? He said, you know what? Don't worry about it. Don't pay me for 12 months. And in 12 months, if I'm doing a good enough job, we'll work something out then. To which I nearly fell off my chair, but was smart enough to, and I reckon he will admit this too. I was smart enough to say, no, I'm going to pay you. I won't reveal what I paid, but it wasn't much. I'm going to pay you a monthly retainer to help us out so that every time I ring you, you're not doing me a favour. I'm actually paying you for this role. I'm not paying you much, but I'm still paying you. I'm paying you what we can afford for someone to do this role. It just happens to be Peter Moody, the, you know, three-time premiership trainer of Black Caviar. Can't believe my luck, but let's do it. And to be fair, and I think he will say this, we had a rollicking good time for 3 years while he did that. He taught me a lot of things. He taught me he's the best thing he did was got me to understand trainers and how they think and how they're trying to run their business and what they're trying to do. And to be fair, we probably had trainers that were doing a good job and were doing just an okay job. So he was able to sort of straighten that up and work through some issues that, you know, might have affected us long term and really helped us and we never changed the fee it never made more. And in fact, he laughs at the fact that the bill, because at that time he thought, well, if I'm coming down seeing you once a month or once every couple of weeks, I may as well have my breeding stock at Rosemont and then I can check on them while I'm there. And we laughed at the fact that I sent him a bigger bill than he sent me an invoice. So I ended up way on top out of that deal. But anyway, he does train quite a few horses for us now, and he might have us on the invoice swap these days. So yeah, but that's the mark of the man. He's a guy that wants to do things his way, and it's not about the money. It's about achievement, and it's about success, and it's about looking after the people that look after you.
This episode is brought to you by Morgan & English Commercial Lawyers, more than just a law firm. They work like external in-house counsel, getting to know you and your business. With offices in Sydney, Scone and Tamworth, and years of experience in the agriculture and thoroughbred industries, Morgan & English deliver practical solutions that work in the real world. Whether it's contracts, disputes or big picture advice, they're the kind of firm you want in your corner. Well, it's certainly been a formidable partnership across a number of years, and it's great to see you still working so closely together, both in somewhat of a media aspect and, of course, in the racing game too. But we'll look back here a little bit just to the early 2000s, where your priorities did change a little bit more to focusing on Rosemont and building that stud to what it is today. Walk us through some of the backstory of the farm. I know that there is a little bit of a story there of some people involved in the farm who did share the same ambitions as you did.
Yeah, well, sort of. It was I was working at Channel 9, so the morph of into where it is today in the short version, which is very difficult for me to give any version short, but I was working at Channel 9. My wife had lived since the age of 19 with my wife on the farm. We had our first child, Patrick, at the age of 19, and we lived on a cottage on the farm and then subsequently built on the farm. My parents-in-law championed people, cattle and sheep farm, but were wholesale rag traders in the clothing game. And the farm, albeit a big farm, 700 acres, it was pretty much a hobby for my father-in-law. He had cattle and sheep, loved his racehorses, owned a few, used to spell them at Di Dennis's in Motawari, just down the road. And I said to him one day, I said, I don't know why you're paying someone to feed your horses when they're spelling, when you've got 700 acres of land. And the first paddock that I sort of encouraged him to do was right out the front of our house. It's now known as Mytho's paddock, and it's has some lovely horses over the years. And that one paddock grew to a couple of more because he had a few more. And then we went to New Zealand and bought a couple of fillies that he wanted to race. So he scratched the racing itch, but was sort of setting up to maybe do some breeding. And he was a goer. He was he had a go at things, Grant. And he died young at the age of 56. In the early 2000s, I was still at Channel 9. It was sudden and a shock to us all. And he had suddenly built up about 15 or 16 broodmares that was a hobby for him. He'd sell the odd one up to Magic Millions, mainly for a holiday and a bit of a yahoo and take the family up there and sell a nice horse. But it was significant enough to not just throw on the scrap heap and pull down the fences and let the cattle and sheep take over again. But it wasn't significant enough that it was going to sustain, a commercial business. So I sort of sat back and thought about where I was at. I was in my early 30s. I didn't really fancy the idea of driving to Melbourne for the rest of my life. Couldn't really think of living anywhere else but the farm, and thought, well, I'm trapped here. I'm either on that highway every day of my life because there's no media job for me in Geelong, or I take a leap of faith and try something else, and perhaps this is the universe telling me to have a go at my own business and do something with what I thought was a reasonable knowledge of racing. Given that I'd interviewed a few trainers in the mounting yard, I suddenly thought I was an expert. And I embarked, the boldness of youth, I suppose, I embarked on turning it into a commercial operation with clients and breeding to sustain a business and sell commercially. And my mother-in-law backed me in and said, okay, if that's what you want to do, because I would like Grant's legacy to stay alive, but I can't do it myself. She had the interest, but she probably just, she'd just lost her husband and didn't really have the drive to go on and make a go of it commercially. So we partnered for a while, and once I turned it into profit, God love her, Heather turned to me and said, look, I don't really want to come to your meetings anymore. I don't want to look at the financial balance sheet. As long as this farm doesn't cost me anything and I can live here and you pay all the bills out of the business, I'm happy with that. You crack on. So that was the arrangement for quite a number of years, which was a great head start for me. I'm under no illusions that I was, given a privileged opportunity, but at the same time, I feel like I made of it a pretty good fist. So that then led to, that was probably nearly 10 years later, my brother-in-law, who had been busy building his retail business, Cotton On, he said to me, look, and he'd built his house at his mother's farm as well. So we're all squatting effectively on my mother-in-law, on her farm. And he said, look, I wouldn't mind buying my own farm, buying my own piece of dirt anyway, but I don't really want to run a commercial operation. What about we do a deal and you can grow Rosemont onto another farm as well as here and hopefully double the business and expand in ways that you'll think of, but we'll go halves in it and I'll support you. So that was sort of how it turned into, Rosemont, Nigel and I, rather than just me. And we've never had a cross word, and it's all been, pretty plain sailing and an adventurous ride from there.
Absolutely. Wow. That is
You want to hear the long version?
No, it's a great story, and it's really like the sliding doors moments, I guess, isn't it? It's it's amazing how things like that come about, and you've really taken, I guess, the farm and made it successful. But we'll touch on now the track, like on the track, your colours of the Red Silks and the White Gate Crusher are synonymous with, you've had so many stars, Brooklyn Hustle, Sneaky Five, and of course stallions like Duel and Schwarz and Extreme Warrior, who we'll talk about soon. Can you talk us through the design for the Silks and how that sort of come about?
Do you know this story?
I don't know.
Oh, you don't? Right. So it started as a joke. So our colours were, it was all very weird because our colours were basically the Essendon Football Club colours, because that is the local football team that my late father-in-law followed. So it was Essendon, but it was really Newtown and Chilwell Football Club. But no one really saw it as that. They couldn't really understand why I was racing colours, being a Richmond man, and I was, at the time I was on the board at the Richmond Footy Club, and I'm racing in Essendon's colours. So that didn't make a lot of sense. But I was reluctant to sort of tip that history to one side. Nige was racing a couple of horses, just himself. His first horse was Cotton on Flyer, who raced in the trainer's colours, in Mark Young's colours. And then he turned up with a few more horses and Secret Flyer hit the scene. So he wouldn't have been the first horse, but he was one of the first horses to wear the red with the white lion. Nige's cousin, Ashley Hardwick, who's now partners with David Moody in contract racing, and is a keen racing man. He has worked for Nige since forever. And one Christmas he decided that he would get Nige a set of Silks. So he thought it would be funny to design the Silks around the logo that they used on the Polo t-shirts. So Polo, t-shirts with the collar were very popular at the time, the Ralph Lauren Polo shirts. And Cotton On thought, well, we can't let them have all the fun. We can probably make them a little cheaper and sell them a little cheaper. But they've got the Polo player as their logo. We need a logo. Not entirely sure. There's various versions of why they chose the Climbing Lion or the Gatecrasher. Stories about a buying trip that ended up in a nightclub called the Gatecrasher, which uses that logo. There's also a story that it can't be copyrighted because it's part of the English coat of arms. So you can't actually, anyone can use it, which is why Peugeot use it. And there's a few other brands that use it, and it's a free for all for anyone to use it. So there was a story about that. I'm not entirely sure of the truth. I just know that was what they settled on to. And they had the best time with these T-shirts. They sold, that one summer, they just sold just thousands and thousands of these T-shirts. So it was a bit of a, it was a boom. It was a bull market for them to sell these T-shirts, and the logo, everything, they got it right. So Ash, in his wisdom, thought it would be funny to design a set of colours for Nige to put on his wall, maybe use on a horse or two, and it's now become the Rosemont stud colours. And I parked the Essendon colours not long after that. I liked Nige's colours and thought, well, maybe I should be using them, given that I had Kevin Sheedy ask me one day on track at Flemington, why do you race in Essendon colours when you're such a staunch Richmond man and your stud is in Geelong? It makes no sense at all. That was the penny drop moment for me, where I thought, yeah, I really need to sort of have a bit of a brand for my colours. And I thought, well, no, I just started to, you know, race a few horses in those colours. Let's go with that and maybe make that our logo. And it's sort of stuck, and it's sort of worked, and it has no more relevance other than it was a doff of the hat to a whole lot of T-shirts that got sold one summer in about 1999.
That's incredible. They've just become so synonymous with racing and, of course, with Rosemont. But Two other key cogs of Rosemont that are very synonymous in the industry are Ryan McAvoy and your brother Teddy. Tell us about the role that these two play in the business and how important it is for the business's functionality as well.
Yeah. Look, Ryan's well known to the industry as a guy who is a very learned, very thoughtful, very considered, and very good judge of a horse, and particularly a young horse. It was a bit of a coup for us to be able to prize him away from Widden, where he'd worked for 10 years. I'd always kept my eye on him because he lived in Melbourne and was a staunch Melbourne man rather than a Sydney sider, and would travel to Widden for sort of a week a month, I think, or, you know, he was backwards and forwards. And I always thought, oh, there's an opportunity there, I reckon. So I had always said to him, if you ever get, I know what it feels like to get sick of travel for your work. If you ever get sick of it, just give me a nod and a wink and let's see if we can work something out. And it was a masterstroke for us, because he's been able to really take our Bloodstock division to a next level. Focus on stallions has been enormous. He's got me in that right headspace for that, and is, you know, he's a good motivating factor for me sometimes when I can sort of throw the toys out of the cot and say, well, this is all a bit hard, and we're battling away down here in little old Geelong, a bit of a one-out farm. He'll pick my socks up and say, come on, you know, back on the bike, let's go again. There's, you know, what about we have a chat about this? And, you know, all credit to him. He deserves all the credit for Henry Longfellow ending up at Rosemont and in Victoria, because I was a bit of a shrug of the shoulders, that's never going to happen. And, you know, despite me saying I'm a yes guy most of the time, that was one that I thought was just a little fanciful. But to be able to pull that off, you know, Ryan deserves a lot of credit for just keeping at me and at me and at me to, you know, go on, get over there to Europe and go and have a look at the horse and go, you know, give MV another call and see what he thinks. And he was just niggling away at me in the background. And, it was a proud moment when he arrived at the farm. So that's Ryan's story. Ted, He's a banker, believe it or not, by profession. He worked at several international banks in London and Singapore and Sydney, and is by far the smartest of the Mithens, and has a crafty mind for business and money and structures of how things can work. So he applies his trade there, as well as having a keen interest in bloodstock, and owns a few mares himself with us, and brings a level of business sophistication to what we do. And, you know, again, is able to probably say to his brother what an employee probably can't say to an employer. So sometimes that's a good thing, sometimes that's a bad thing. but we seem to work it out mostly. So it's a great team. Justin McCusker, who's our cousin, is our head of finance and HR, and he's been a mainstay with me. He's been there longer than either of those guys, and been terrific for me to have that surety of, Selena and Nigel's cousin, running our financial sector of the business. It gives me a great peace of mind, which is great that he's got our best interests at heart, and he's a thoughtful guy and a considered guy when it comes to HR. And I'd like to think that we're a good employer because of the efforts that he puts in. I could go on. Amy's a great stud secretary, and, you know, Lisa does a great job. And Charlie, a young bloodstock guy who would be well known at sales, he's a great young talent that is going places for sure. And, he'd be a leading candidate for a Godolphin Flying Start or one of those programs at some stage in his career, and would love to see him get that opportunity. So, and then we've got the staff that live outside of the office, which are the backbone of the place. But it's a good team, and one that I'm proud of, because it's probably what I spend the most time on, trying to make sure that team is doing the best job they can and supported the best they can, and we're forever evolving into the best version of ourselves.
A good team is worth its weight in gold, and it's hard to achieve things without a good team behind you, for sure. But we'll talk a little bit about some people you've worked with externally, and one of those is who you've worked closely with is Wiley Dalziel. Obviously, Mr. Quickie being the superstar you had, and he was a great horse, had a great career, and now that he lives his days out at Rosemont.
Yeah, we have got some stars in the nanny brigade, and Mr. Quickie's one of them. And that was really born out. I've known Wiley through sort of, you know, back when I was battling away with a four-horse draft at Melbourne Premier, and they were the only yearlings I was selling. Wiley was out there doing his Chefs on the Run thing with Roy Higgins, and we knew each other, but we really sort of became friends and started working together professionally through Peter. Obviously, Peter had a lot of horses for him when he took his sabbatical, and he encouraged me to hook up with Wiley. He said, "You'll like Wiley. He's one of us. He's an honest guy. He's got a good business. He tries hard. He's not out for himself. He's actually out for the horse and the achievement, and doing it with his mates and clients. And I saw that firsthand. You know, there was time there through COVID, or it might have been just before COVID, where he was literally trying to get multis up to pay his mortgage because things were tough. It was hard to run a syndication business and stay afloat. And do it in a straight down the line way, and he was determined to do it that way, and he's to be admired for what he's been able to achieve and the business that he's been able to write. But that happens if you keep doing the right things. You know, if you stay down the track of I'm going to run an honest business. I'm going to look after my customers. I'm going to look after my clients. And I'm going to partner with good people, you usually come out on top. But you know, he's an interesting story, Wiley. He'll openly. I hope he doesn't mind me saying that. I don't think he will. He says that openly because it illustrates, you know, how tricky running your own business is at times, and what you've got to do to just get by. So thankfully, he's a very good punter. So he was able to survive.
The gift of the gab, the great punt. When you're out inspecting horses at, say, Magic Millions, which, of course, at the time of recording we're coming up to now, compared to, say, Inglis Easter, it's two sales where we'd likely see the breeding alliance that Rosemont is involved in play a big part. What is it exactly that you're looking for in a yearling at both of these sales, and who holds the final decision behind these purchases?
It is a team effort, and I mean, ultimately, I try not to be, the boss with the final say, but ultimately it is me, and Ryan will remind me of that sometimes. It'll be like, Mitho, this is your call. You don't say yes to this because you're wanting to include everyone, or you're wanting everyone to have a voice. If you're not feeling it, this is your business. Ultimately, it'll be on you. So it's a nice thing to be reminded of by team members. So ultimately, it is my call on that front. We didn't buy yearlings last year with the alliance. We sort of felt after 4 years we'd struck a few blows. We pretty well had repeat. Customers, you know, repeat clients going back in and tipping their money back in, and I was feeling like there was a bit of, you know, financial fatigue. It's a big chunk to ask people to pay. I don't care how rich you are, no one wants to just keep risking money, you know. Thankfully, we've been reasonably successful in producing a stallion out of each of our crops. Buying 12 horses a year and finding Duel our first year, Schwartz our second year, Bizusto's still racing, but he'll end up in the barn. And the fourth year are only three-year-olds now. But I just thought it was probably fair play to just say, hey, everyone take a breather. You can come in a few things that we do. And we also, it's morphing a little bit because of You might remember a few years ago when Shadwell had their dispersal sale at Magic Millions and sold all the mares, and we were quite active at that sale, spent quite a bit of money. You know, Nige really wanted to up the ante in terms of the quality of the mares that he owned. And that's now morphing, well, it's become progeny of that, of those mares are in our backyard, and we're looking at those horses saying, well, these are as good as the ones we're going to go and buy. What about we invite partners in on our own bred stock? And to be that, I mean, that looks a bit self-serving, and I'm always checking myself and saying, well, am I doing this because this is self-serving, or am I doing this because this is a good opportunity for one of my clients to get involved and race a nice horse with us? And I keep answering it with that, to be fair. And I feel like we're getting some endorsement for our product on the racetrack that is further justification for that tactic. So those alliance partners that have supported us are sort of getting that opportunity to come in horses that we've bred, and we're treating them like our alliance package, you know. And it's not really music to the ear of the sales companies that we're turning up and putting our hand in the air for $1 million colts, but eventually you get the stitch doing that, I reckon. So hopefully we can produce our own.
The Brisbane Racing Club, Queensland's premier destination for horse racing, events and world-class hospitality. As a Brisbane Racing Club member, you'll enjoy exclusive perks and unforgettable experiences at one of Australia's leading racing clubs. Unlock unlimited members reserve access across Eagle Farm and Doomben, including the thrilling 2026 Stradbroke season. Join today at brc.com.au and feel closer to the thrill, prestige and excitement of Brisbane's thoroughbred racing scene.
One of those yearlings you purchased for the Breeding Alliance that has paid off was Schwarz, and he's joined your roster this year. We spoke a couple of weeks ago and you said he's really taken it by storm. And I remember he really impressed me at your parade because it was absolutely bucketing down with rain and he walked around like he was a little pony. He was just beautiful. How's he gone this season, and I guess how have the breeders taken to him?
I just could not believe that parade day, just to touch on that for a minute. Like, we, every other stallion walked out, we saved the best till, well, the newest flash, new shiny toy till last, and it rained as he walked out of the box. He, despite that, I think everyone would acknowledge that he is a lovely prospect. He's a beautiful animal, and Taylor, I think you would attest to that. He's a beauty. So he, I should have prepped up for this, but I've been in holiday mode up here on the Gold Coast. So he covered around 150 mares. He ran at high 87, 88% fertility rate. He's had a smashing first season. I think one of our Instagram posts that didn't quite go viral, but it got a lot of traction, was early on, where every stud master wants to tell everyone that the horse is going well and it's fertile and got the first ones in foal. I was going to say creative license, but it was the fact. But I felt like it was fun to do it this way, that he got 14 pregnancies out of the first 10 mares checked, which was so bad. People get scratching their head going, huh, what did he just say? So we sort of played on that a bit, that he obviously had four sets of twins. So it was a dynamic start, and you know, he's a fertile horse. He's still a kind horse. I love that about him. And John O'Shea, and I think he said it on the day, Taylor, he's always had this unbelievable temperament, and John sort of feels like he's a beautiful horse with a beautiful action and obviously talented, but the attitude of the horse has been sort of a bit rock star-esque, just so cool and calm and knows what he's doing and never flustered. And I love him for that, and I was a little worried covering his first mare and then his second and his third. I thought, will he get that aggressive streak, and will he change his attitude? And he walks up to you in the paddock like he's an old lamb, looks for a pat, drops his head. I reckon he knows me, which I really love as well. He's just kept that cool dude attitude. Now, if he throws that into his progeny, I mean, the sky's the limit. If they look like him and think like him, there could be some fireworks with Schwartz. So, and the chance he's been given, we've sent him some lovely mares, and don't ask me because I haven't done that research either. So, but he got some of those mares that we've spent a lot of money for. So he's an exciting prospect and one we're very proud of.
He certainly has an exciting future ahead, as does Extreme Warrior. I guess we know he's battled some issues in the barn, but his first season, he's made such an impressive start. Obviously, he's currently third on the first season side table at the time of recording. Two winners, two place getters, and a stakes winner. Couldn't have a much better start. How was his 2025 breeding season, and what have you made of that success? I'm sure it's very rewarding.
Yeah, it is. He's a horse that we obviously have a lot to do with the family. We own a lot of the family, and we came into our 10%. And he raced in the Rosemont colours. We only owned 10% when he raced through a gentleman called Richard Boyd, who has raced all the other progeny with us, Thrillstar, Free Thrills. What else have we had in that family? Skidamarink. He didn't go in Skidamarink. We bought her for a lot of money at the sales after the family had exploded. But he was kind enough to sort of say, hey, you need to be in this horse. After he'd trialled it, might have even been after his first start, he said, look, you guys need to be in this. This is something, this might be something a bit special. And Mick Price and Mick Kent are very enamoured with the horse. So, you know, hats off to Richard for thinking of us, and we did a little side deal, and we traded a bit of bloodstock to sort of make it all work for everyone. And, you know, then, look, to be fair, he won the Blue Sapphire in our ownership, and then went to the Blue Diamond. Went to the Cornwall as favourite. He had knee issues at the time. He was hanging on by a thread, and unfortunately that thread broke in the Cornwall. Not a great day for that to happen, but you know, it was a bit of a flattening moment. But you know, I remember Mick Price saying to me, after he'd won his maiden, no, he might have lost a race leading up to the Blue Sapphire, and Mick said to me, I'm just going to treat him like he won that race, and we're going to go to the Blue Sapphire, because if he'd won that race, I would go to the Blue Sapphire. He should have won that race. He didn't win the race. Let's just treat him like we know he's a proper one, so let's treat him like a proper one. So I like that attitude, and we've sort of, you know, in some ways we've taken that to the barn. Said, let's treat him like he didn't win a Group One. He had, you know, he had issues on Cornwall Day. That's okay. We can treat him like he's a proper one. He's well bred. He's by a freak of a stallion. He's a beautiful horse. He's a real, not a big horse, but he's a really strong, fast. Looks like what the market wants. Looks like a bullet. So let's treat him like he's a proper one. So we did, you know, unfortunately then you end up with some fertility issues in the barn like his father, and you gnash your teeth and, you know, you think, well, gee, what are we going to get with this horse? So I'm happy to cop the fertility issues if he also gives us the talented progeny. But we don't know. So it's that 3-year period until you get to the racetrack with the progeny where you're just sort of throwing your hands in the air going, I don't know whether I'm an idiot or I'm a genius doing any of this with this horse, or do we just swoop in and get on with something else? But we've stuck the distance, and then to see his progeny do so well so early and look like early runners, he's the first season stallion with the least number of two-year-olds. He's only got 47, I think, Taylor. You're probably better at stats than I am, but 48 maybe, 47, 48. It's not many. And to have so many get to the racetrack before Christmas, have a stakes winner, have a Saturday City winner, a couple of place getters. It's pointing in the right direction for him. And to be, I think, I'm disappointed to hear he's dropped to third. Stainside's got past him, has he? He must have had a little run of the last couple of days, because we were wedged between Stainside and Home Affairs there for the new year anyway. So something's happened in the last few days while I wasn't paying attention. But we know we've got some really nice horses to produce ourselves. We're racing six or seven of those 47 ourselves, and really excited about a couple of them. So we know there's more to come. And there's a few trainers that have tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey, I think you'd be all right with this horse. We've got one that we really like. So it's a small sample, but he's only got a small crop. So in comparison, he's doing exceptionally well. So we'll just keep treating him like he's a proper one. And if he is, we're happy to do the work to get more mares in foal. He has improved each year, not substantially, but we're learning more each year with him, and learning, you know, they still trick you. There's still flat patches where I think there was a patch there this year where he got seven mares in foal and then went 10 days without getting a mare in foal. Now, how you work that out as a stud master and what you do with that is anyone's guess, but we'll keep guessing because it looks like he's going to be worth it.
What amazes me about Extreme Warrior is how you say he has the least number of two-year-olds going around, yet he's already had six runners on the track. We're looking at comparisons to the likes of Home Affairs, Wild Ruler, Tiger and Malay, those horses that you'd expect to have the sharp two-year-olds, and he's getting them too. So it just, you know, credit to probably how Rosemont have looked after the horse as well, and you know, credit to the horse as well for being potentially a very highly rated stallion. But yeah, we'll touch on another horse on your roster here, Henry Longfellow. He was a personal first season sire favourite of mine last season from the Stallion Parade Tour. He's just a beautiful type of horse, and I just feel he's probably suited to the Victorian market as well, suited to Victorian mares. And I don't know, that I've just got this feeling with him that he's going to do very well over here. How strong was his first book of mares, and what do you expect from those first foals when we see them next year? Well, this year now, I should say.
Yeah, it's exciting. It comes around pretty quickly. In fact, we're probably only days away from the first Northern Hemisphere Henry Longfellow being born. So that's an exciting prospect. We get a little sneak preview of what's to come. But I still pinch myself. I mean, this is a major coup for the Australian breeding industry, let alone the Victorian breeding industry, let alone for Rosemont. I mean, when you line up the resume and what he's got going for him, it's a bit like, what more do you want? Like, there's no other box to tick here. He's a Group One winner at two. He's bied to Bowie. He's out of the best Galileo mare there is that Galileo's ever produced in Minding, who won seven Group Ones before she turned four. He's a beautiful horse. It's sort of pedigree, type, racetrack performance, and we stood in for 22,000. Like, it's a bit like, what? How did all that happen? Which I can rewind and tell you the story, which I think is probably worth doing. And hats off to Coolmore, who I've built a really strong relationship with, MV and Tom, over the course of the last 15 years through the Star Spangled Banner story. And it's amazing, you know, if you stick to your guns, you usually earn respect rather than anything else, don't you? Especially if you're right. It's different if you're wrong, but occasionally you get it right and things evolve from there. And that was the story with Star Spangled Banner. I won't bore everyone with those details, but the short version was that he went to start, he had fertility issues. We owned 5%. Coolmore wanted to geld him and send him back to the racetrack. And I put my foot down and said, no, we won't be doing that. And if you do, there'll be repercussions. And they had to sort of take a step back and have a think about whether they wanted to, piss off a little Geelong farm stud master and kick him to the curb, or are we doing? And I'm certain that would have been. Are we doing enough business with this bloke to justify letting him have his way, borderline. We're doing a little bit. He sends mares every year. Oh, look, is it going to matter that we don't geld him? Probably not. All right, no worries. Don't geld him. What do you want to do with the horse then? Oh, well, I want to go with him, you know. And we've seen Staff Bengal Banner emerge into, well, he's equal highest priced stallion on the Cornwall roster in Europe this year. So it's a, you know, it's a nice story, and it's nice to be right. And I did it out of desperation. I won't tell that story, but it was a throw up the stumps that where I hit him from pine leg. So that then led to a really, you know, strong relationship with MV and Tom. And we've just always got along well. And we've been sort of looking for an opportunity. Well, I have. I don't think they have, but I've been looking for an opportunity to sort of use that friendship to Rosemont's good. And I don't mind if Tom and MB hear that. They would understand that's the way the world works. And I called in the favour on Henry Longfellow effectively. And at the time, and still, like, they, you know, they were chock-a-block full of stallions, and they were obviously going to shuttle City of Troy. Did they really want to be launching two shuttle horses into the Hunter Valley? Tricky market for shuttle horses. I was able to be persuasive on that point. We were able to nut out a deal that suited everyone. So still can't believe it. Still can't believe that we can tap into that rare pedigree. You know, son of Dubawi, out of Minding, got to keep saying it because I pinched myself otherwise, and a beautiful horse. So I would expect to see horses that will be, I don't think they'll be screaming before Christmas two-year-olds, but they'll be two-year-olds. They'll be, I'd be disappointed if he didn't have a dozen runners by sort of, you know, that size produce weekend, and they're probably going to be that sort of horse, a size produce into a Brisbane carnival two-year-olds. But gee, I reckon they'll take the world by storm when they turn three. That's, you know, we're guessing, and I think that Australian speed will really help him as well. The speed in the mares here, I could see him being a horse that works better here than in Europe. I might be wrong, but We'll wait and see with bated breath. But yeah, he's an exciting prospect and one that I'm very privileged to have.
Here's hoping lightning can strike twice and you'll end up with another Star Spangled Banner, another feather in your cap. But we'll finish off and we'll just talk about, I guess you're probably well poised to speak on this, like, having been on the TBV board and owning and being part of one of the biggest studs in Victoria. Where do you feel the Victorian breeding industry currently sits within the Australian breeding industry? And I guess, what do you think the upside is of breeding and racing in Victoria?
Well, it's a great place to rear a horse, firstly. I mean, there's no coal mines. That sort of helps. And look, I probably just offended 3/4 of the breeding population, but I mean that's a fact, and every farm in the Hunter Valley laments that. It's not a, you know, it's a great unspoken, isn't it, really? But we've got great land to breed horses, and I don't really understand why, but we're cheaper. That's the other point that I constantly scratch my head at Victorian breeders that leave their mares in the Hunter Valley, and like, well, Victorian based business people who don't necessarily have a farm that elect to have their horses in the Hunter Valley and pay the Hunter Valley tax. But I don't really understand it. So I don't see any real reason why you would, other than that's your home. If your home's New South Wales and Sydney, and you know, like, yeah, but in the Hunter Valley, but I'm constantly running into, or not constantly, but I do run into a few people who, oh no, I have my horses in the Hunter and that's where they are, and you know, well, no, I couldn't possibly send a mare to Henry Longfellow or Schwartzmitho, because you know, then they've got to come all the way down to Victoria, and you're sort of left sort of scratching your head thinking, well, why wouldn't you just have your mares in Victoria in the first place? And if not, by the way, we send a lot of mares up to the Hunter Valley and do it quite successfully from Geelong to the Hunter Valley and back again. And we've got shares in Bivouac and Animo and I'm Invincible and Capitalist and are happy to support sort of, you know, stallions that we like going back the other way. So we lost a few bookings with Henry Longfellow, people that were keen to use the horse, but clients just said, oh, we just won't send mares outside of the Hunter Valley, which I was staggered at. I just think, well, that to me, that's just a bozo way of breeding. Like you in Europe, they'll send mares from England to Ireland and over to France and go to where the mare is best suited to that stallion that suits your breeding program. To do it just on location sort of seems very strange to me. So I was actually quite surprised how many mares we lost because of that this year. I shook my head a number of times at that attitude. Now, maybe that's what they told me and they just didn't want to let me down with, we don't like your stallion, but pretty hard not to like, you know, the Group 1 winning Son of Zoustar and, you know, the son of the Bowie that's out of the best mare Galileo's ever had. I'm a firm believer that Victoria is a great place to breed a horse. I'm not saying it's the best place to breed a horse. I don't know what is, but I reckon that we're headed in the right direction. And hats off to Yulong and Mr. Zhang and what he's done and the way he's supported Victorian breeding and said, well, I feel like he's got my attitude of, well, why can't we just stand these nice stallions in Victoria? And why can't I have all my mares in Victoria? And why don't I do it there? Because it's going to be a bit cheaper. So I don't think the cheap thing is it comes into his equation, but it's an endorsement of our land and our climate and what we're doing. And you can stand these quality commercial stallions in Victoria at a good fee. One of the best stallions in the country in Written Tycoon is, you know, standing in Victoria under the careful guidance of Sam Fairgrey and the team at Yulong, and they're doing a brilliant job. So, I think we're going the right way, slowly but surely.
We'll just finish off the episode with our Fast Five segment, which is just five quick fire questions to answer, just to get to know you a little bit better and a bit more personal. We'll kick off. On the sales circuit, do you prefer a night in or a night out?
I'm probably a night out sort of guy. Yeah. Nothing too silly. A nice dinner and a good bottle of Chablis or Pinot Noir, and certainly home before midnight, Taylor.
Not punching around the casino at 1 a.m, are we?
No. Those days are gone there, Justin, unfortunately.
Mitha, if you took off somewhere for a one-week holiday, where are you going?
Tokyo.
Beautiful. Who is your favourite horse that you've raced?
It should come instantly, shouldn't it? But probably Mr. Quickie.
Yeah, the little superstar. Did you have any idols growing up at all?
No, Richmond footballers mainly. Yeah.
Any in particular?
Kevin Bartlett, Michael Roach, and I'd throw in Viv Richards.
Love it.
And finally, what's one piece of advice you'd give to someone looking to pave their way into the world of racing, whether it be media or breeding?
Be honest. Live by the fact that you've got to live with yourself.
Mitho, thank you so much for coming on this podcast today. We appreciate you taking the time out of your day. Of course, this is recorded in the lead up to Magic Millions, so it is a busy time of year for you. So again, thank you very much. We look forward to seeing you at Magic Millions. Wish you the best of luck and, of course, for the remainder of the sales season as well.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you, Taylor. Look forward to seeing you at the Gold Coast where I am now. Brilliant sunshine. I don't think that's going to be for Magic Millions week, unfortunately, but here's hoping we get a race day away.
Fingers crossed. Well, by the time this comes out, we'll certainly know that.